like your head because I like my head. On this episode of the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast, we talk about wonderful ways to protect your head with Kyle Kitzman from Bell Helmets, one of the world's most famous and respected makers of automotive racing helmets. That's the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast, episode 46. Hey everybody, great show for you this week on the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast. JG Pastorjack here, episode 46, Kyle Kitzman from Bell Helmets. Very, very cool stuff, talking about the past, present, future of automotive racing helmets. And look, this is something that sort of everybody that is listening to this that has ever competed in any sort of event or even done non-competition track events has this in common. You need a helmet. Whether you're going to be autocrossing or road racing or just doing track events, it's kind of the thing that binds us all together. And Kyle was nice enough to take some time out to talk to us about how they develop stuff and how they test stuff, and it's all very cool. He's probably seen a lot more pictures of injured heads than I have in my life, but that's one of the probably downsides of his job. Anyway, how's everybody doing today? This is the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast. If you would like to subscribe to one of our print magazines, you may visit grassrootsmotorsports.com/discount or classicmotorsports.com/discount to subscribe to Grassroots Motorsports Magazine or Classic Motorsports Magazine. This is the semi-biweekly podcast of those two magazines. And as always, we appreciate you guys being here. What else is going on? We got the MIDI coming up in another week or so. If you guys are listening to this in real time, hopefully if you have not made your plans to visit the MIDI at Road Atlanta, the Classic Motorsports MIDI celebrating BMW this year, please make plans to do that. That is always a very, very cool thing to do. And lots of cool stuff going on this year between the skid pad challenge and all the, like, there's several clubs that are making it their annual convention there. So there's going to be all kinds of cool cars in the infield. Please, if you haven't made a decision about what you're doing next week with the MIDI, just do it. Just show up. It's cheap. It's a fun weekend, and it gives you an excuse to go to Road Atlanta. All right, let's get right to the talking to Kyle Kitzman. Nice guy. Lots of great information on helmet buying, helmet choosing, and just kind of what goes into developing and producing these things that keep our heads safe, and why. I mean, of course, we all probably hopefully know why it's important to keep our heads safe, but hopefully is able to kind of structure it in such a way that, anyway, puts numbers on it. Oh, also at one point I totally embarrassed myself by starting to talk about Bell driving suits, and in my defense, they did have a line of driving suits a few years ago, but they've since discontinued that or just doing helmets, and, you know, good for them. They're doing a great job. All right, enjoy. Here's our chat with Kyle Kitzman. We'll be back in a little bit to wrap things up, and here you go. Really, really good. And then we'll just get going. So how's things at Bell?
Things are fantastic. We're in the process of preparing everything for the next homologation cycle with Snell that takes effect in October of this year.
Yeah, and that's something I definitely want to get into. And as well as I had a situation come up recently, not only with Snell homologation, but with having a situation where I needed some gear that was FIA homologated, and found some really interesting things, in that regard too. But before we get into that, let's back up a little bit. So we're with Kyle. Pronounce your last name for me. Is it Kitzman?
It's actually Kitzman.
Kitzman. Okay, Kyle Kitzman from Bell Racing. And here's the question. It's hard to ask safety guys this, but it's the one that I think that whether or not people know they're doing this, this is kind of their decision making process when it comes to safety gear. But for whatever reason, you know, racers will spend tens of thousands of dollars on nitrogen filled, you know, cross drilled lug nuts that save half an ounce per corner, but they always seem to want to cut corners on safety gear. And you know, the the sanctioning bodies will establish sort of minimum standards for safety gear, and it's pretty easy to meet those minimum standards when it comes to safety gear. So the question that I always like to ask safety guys is, it's easy to meet those minimum standards, but it's also pretty easy to spend more money and to get, you know, what would likely be higher quality safety gear. When you exceed those minimum standards, or when you sort of go higher up on the hierarchy of pricing and safety gear, what are you getting? Like what's the difference between the high end stuff and the minimum standard stuff?
Yeah, that's always a question we get. You know, why is what's the difference between a helmet that might cost me $300 that meets a certain specification versus a helmet that may cost $600? And what you really get into is, you know, at the entry level, you know, you have more basic interior fit. You've got simpler designs, simpler features, and as you go up the you know, various product lines, especially the Bell product line, then you get into helmets that have more features, that might be lighter weight, that have more complex interiors, better fit. You know, it's kind of how you would look at a lineup for an automobile company. So if you looked at, you know, Chevrolet's lineup, for example, you would look at their base model, and then as you go up through their midsize and their larger cars, the difference is really performance, features, new innovations that are incorporated into the helmets. So that's really what you're paying for.
And as far as the actual safety of the stuff, I would imagine there's probably not that big of a spread from your lower cost stuff to your higher cost stuff, because you know they all do have to meet those minimum standards. But are you paying for some additional safety as well in some of the goods?
Well, you are in some cases. For example, we make a line of helmets that are certified to the FIA 8860 standard, which was really designed for Formula One. And so within that standard, it has to meet the Snell requirements, but then there's additional requirements that have to meet for the FIA, which includes a 5-meter drop from a testing standpoint that it has to adhere to. So it has higher energy management thresholds that it has to achieve than what you'd say would be a regular Snell homologated helmet.
So give us an idea of what a helmet actually goes through to get to Snell rated or FIA rated. What's sort of the minimum requirements that they actually will go through and take prototypes and test them? You know, what are they actually doing to certify that helmet?
Well, basically, we're, you know, people may not be familiar with the helmet testing process, but essentially there's a drop tower, and there's a series of anvils that the helmets are dropped onto. And inside the head form that holds the helmet in place during the testing process, there's an accelerometer. And that accelerometer is essentially measuring the amount of energy that is transmitted to the center of the brain. So the objective is to reduce the amount of energy that's transmitted and increase the amount of energy that's absorbed by the helmet. So on a standard Snell test, if you just drop the head form without any protection, you may register, you know, an impact of 800 to 900 G's, which is, you know, 1 G equals one time the force of gravity. And in the Snell scenario, typically, you know, at one point it was considered that anything above 300 G's would be considered a fatal impact. So what we do with a helmet is, if we have a normal impact from a drop tower, that helmet would maybe register about 150 to 170 G's on a normal impact. So what that's telling you is that the helmet is really doing a great job of absorbing a lot of the energy that otherwise would have been transmitted to the center of the brain. So that's, you know, the basics of what we get into when we do testing. And obviously it's a very complicated process. So what we do, after we've done all of our in-house testing, we will send certification samples to an independent testing organization, whether that be Snell or Newton, and they verify that the helmet itself meets and passes all the homologation tests. So there's various different impacts with the Snell standard on various different head forms and in different temperature conditions. And all of that is designed to help us make sure that the helmet is absorbing as much energy as possible. And go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just thinking, so what is the difference between, say, you know, a current Snell 2010 helmet and, you know, a Snell 85 helmet or a Snell 90 helmet? Like have things gotten considerably better over the years, or have they sort of peaked? Like is the technology getting better with every generation?
Well, the technology is absolutely getting better with every generation because the standards and the thresholds in terms of energy management that you've had to adhere to have increased. So, you know, the byproduct of that is that you've seen a lot of development in terms of the energy absorbing liner systems and also the technology that's going into building the shells, not only the material side with more advanced carbon materials, but also the production side in terms of using more compression molding to build a stronger shell that's still lighter weight. And what you've noticed over the years, if you followed helmets, you know, especially since about the mid-60s, you've noticed that they've started to gradually increase in volume. And the reason that is because the standards themselves have increased in terms of the energy that the helmet has to absorb. And that's determined by, how tall on the drop tower the helmet has to drop from. And that's measured by a velocity gauge to determine how quickly that helmet is moving on the test rig and how much energy it's actually seeing. So we've seen all of those standards increase dramatically.
So the helmets we have today, is there anything like I'm sort of comparing this to the situation they're facing in the NFL. And, you know, of course, those guys are going to use their helmets more in a day than we hopefully ever are in our racing careers. But, I've heard before that the helmets they use in the NFL, if they could take a clean sheet of paper and redesign those helmets, that they might sort of be in a better situation. But they also would have to be making a lot of compromises that people wouldn't be willing to make. Like, for example, I've heard that just putting the padding on the outside of the helmet in that type of situation could cut down on concussions. Are we sort of auto racing doesn't really necessarily have the visibility of the helmets the way something like the NFL does, but are the helmets we have today, you know, are there sort of any compromises that we're looking at because this has been the traditional design of helmets throughout the years, is a, you know, an outer shell with inner padding outside of a head. I mean, if we could start with a clean slate, is this what we would end up with, what we have today, you think?
I think in auto racing, it's very, very close to what we would end up with, because what you're dealing with the racing helmet is that you are trying to absorb as much energy as possible so that it's not transmitted to the driver. And the way the helmet does that is it does that in a destructive process. So, it starts by the shell deforming and delaminating to help absorb energy and also spread the energy of the impact over a wider area. And then the energy absorbing liner system takes over, and that helps to really bring the head to a slower deceleration and to prevent, you know, as much as possible those internal head injuries. What we're also seeing with the increases in the specification and requirements is we're seeing stronger, lighter shells, so lighter overall helmets that are a little bit more rigid. And then we've seen the inner liner materials increase not only in volume, but there's also been a decrease in absolute density. So that combination has really created a helmet that, in an impact, is performing pretty well.
Yeah, and while you mentioned that the volume is getting bigger slightly, which you can you know, see the helmet's getting physically bigger, the weight is probably staying down to a pretty acceptable level for this stuff too. So what, I mean, I don't know how much speculation you're willing or you're able to do, but what's sort of the next big step? We're talking about helmets being sort of a passive safety device. Is the next big step in development some sort of active safety? I mean, are we ever going to see, you know, airbags or some kind of smart materials, or, you know, what's kind of on the drawing board that you guys would like to be able to implement there?
Well, obviously, you know, we're somewhat cautious about what we talk about in terms of what we have in mind. But I will say that if you look at the racing industry in general, we're all starting to look at the safety systems for the driver as more of a complete package, where, you know, there's been a lot of work that's been done on restraint systems. There's been a lot of work that's been done on the seats and head surrounds and tons type devices, head and neck restraint devices. So, you know, all of those things are, you're seeing that become more integrated. And I think that that trend will only continue as we move forward. And certainly in terms of, you know, more active devices that can help to preempt energy absorbing situations, I think that's some technology that certainly you'll see in the future. You're going to see more custom liner scans on the high end for helmets that are developed that are more designed appropriately for someone's individual anatomy. That's something that you know, we're already implementing in some cases, and you'll see that continue in the future.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. So, you know, everybody certainly has a different shaped head, and it's certainly a factor of comfort, but I would imagine it's also a factor of safety, getting a proper fit on the helmet. Just so, you know, as you're sort of attenuating these impacts and mitigating these accelerations, there's not sort of open areas to accelerate into. So if I'm helmet shopping, what are, you know, how do I fit a helmet to my head, assuming I don't want to have something, you know, custom molded, or I can't afford to have something custom molded to my head? But what am I looking for in helmet fitment and sort of general, you know, is something loose better? Is something tight better? How do I know I'm as safe as I can be inside a bucket like that?
Yeah, well, certainly the helmet fit is an important issue, because I think that one of the biggest challenges, especially as the distribution model for safety equipment has changed from more ease shops and maybe direct contact with salespeople to more internet direct-based purchasing, the fit aspect, I think, has suffered. And, you know, customers tend to gravitate toward helmets that might be too big for them simply because they feel that it's more comfortable. And they don't take into account, in some cases, that the padding itself may break end over time. So I think that there are scenarios where you may have customers that essentially are wearing helmets that are one size or even two sizes too large for them. But the basic process for measuring starts with essentially a measuring tape. So what you would want to do is measure about an inch above the eyebrow and find the largest circumference that you can by measuring around the head to the back of the head. And that's going to give you a measurement in either inches or centimeters. And something that we do at Bell is we publish you know, a sizing chart that'll give you a general idea of where you might be in the Bell product line. And that's kind of considered a starting point. And then from there, then you want to go through a process of actually trying on the helmet. In the ideal scenario, you could try the helmet that you So as being measured in terms of the size that's appropriate for you, and then maybe even trying a size down if needed, or a size up if needed. So that's the basic starting point. You know, we ask the person to try it on to make sure that their eyes are pretty much in the center of the eye port, and then we check for movement. So we kind of rotate the helmet sideways, and we rotate the helmet up and down. And what we want to see there is we want to see that, you know, the helmet all around the padding is making good contact with the skin. So when I move that helmet from side to side or up and down, I'm going to see some skin move. And that tells me that, you know, it's sized appropriately for the person. Now, everybody's head shape is differently, and just because you measure a certain size doesn't mean that you necessarily are that size. So really we suggest that that you try helmets on, that you keep them on for a certain period of time, that you check for any pressure points that you may be having, you know, and resist the temptation to gravitate to something that's too loose just because you think it's more comfortable.
And then are there any options, sort of affordable, in the affordable realm, to sort of customize from there, like different padding sets available or anything that we can kind of custom fit this stuff to a specific size face at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that you get into is the crown is a certain measurement, but then everybody's, you know, the physical shape of their jawline, or, you know, how wide they are in the cheeks, all those things may change. So we have different padding systems. For our youth helmets, we have removable fit pads and removable cheek pads that can be, you know, replaced accordingly. We also have cheek pad inserts that we use, where if you have someone that has a larger head but a real narrow face, a lot of times they need to tighten up the fit in the cheek pad area. So we've got those systems that can work with that. So we're really conscious of that, and being able to make the helmet as adjustable as possible, you know, and yet still having the integrity itself maintain have a certain integrity to it, so that, you know, when you're in an impact, you don't have pieces of the interior flying out and those types of things.
So I may or may not know of people who theoretically have taken their cheek pads and maybe pulled the liner back and shaved them down a little bit to fit their specific face. Would you ever recommend somebody do that, or do you really need to stick with the ones that are designed by the company? Because once you peel that liner back, you've somehow compromised something, or once you sort of alter the shape of that foam, you've compromised something safety wise. Or is there a way to get away with a little bit of sort of home custom fitting?
Anytime someone modifies the helmet in a way other than prescribed by the manufacturer, essentially that voids the warranty, and there's no way for us to, you know, be assured that it's going to perform as it was intended when it came from the factory and out of the box. So what we would recommend is that, you know, we make certain kits available that people can use on their own, that they can customize their helmet themselves, and we're comfortable with that. Anything outside of that, you know, what we would recommend is that, you know, in Bell's case, you'd call us, talk through the issue that you're having, and then we could deal with it from a customer service standpoint and help you make the changes that are necessary to make the helmet fit comfortably for you. But we really advise against people going in and altering their helmets, because, you know, you never know what may occur, and you know, for instance, we certainly don't want somebody to damage an integral part of the system, like the chin strap retention system or something like that. So we really advise people to, you know, go look at the accessories that are available to custom fit the helmet themselves, and then anything beyond that, you know, call the factory and call us, and we'll work through those issues with them.
Okay, so the takeaway message is, You probably have more options available to you than you think you do before you, you know, take a carpet knife to the lining of your helmet yourself in your garage and start, you know, hot gluing things back together. You may be able to get it taken care of by the people that designed it.
And we recognize too that there's real world aspects that we have to realize, and that's obviously people put install radio communication gear in helmets, so The majority of our helmets have base pieces that can be removed so that you can install radios. And actually, they have recesses and channels in the back of the face pieces so that people can install radio hardware in the helmet without having to take a razor blade and hollow something out and do those types of things. So we are conscious of the fact that, you know, there are other aspects of helmets in terms of radio communication that occurs, and we have to design the product accordingly.
So now on the other end of the spectrum, do I have the option to go somewhere and have, you know, a mold pulled off my head and have a helmet custom fitted directly to my head, or do they still have to meet certain shape and size standards on the inside?
We are doing that with especially with some of the Formula One drivers at this point, and we are working toward, you know, having that option available for the general consumer. So I think within the near future, at least with the Bell product line, you know, customers on the higher end will have that option.
Okay, so you mentioned your product sort of working as a system. Talk a little bit about some of Bell's other stuff. But now, I know Bell makes suits as well. Do you guys do from head to toe? Are you sort of a head to toe safety company at this point?
Well, at this point, Bell Racing is really actually just focused on helmets. So we were in the suit business, the head to toe business for a period of time, and you know, just based on the heritage of the company and where we're positioned in the marketplace, it made more sense for us to really focus the Bell brand on just helmets.
Okay, so I guess I have some old information there, but wouldn't be the first time. So when it comes to the head and neck restraints, I mean, obviously Hans is kind of the, I don't know if you'd say industry standard, but certainly the, you know, the most widely known out there, but there are some other options out there as well. Is there one sort of system that Bell prefers over the other ones, or is there one that works better with Bell helmets than the other ones available out there?
One of the things you've seen with head and neck restraint systems is the standardization that has occurred is really from an anchor's perspective. So every helmet that'll be homologated to the Bell 2015 standard or any of the FIA standards, they'll require something called an M6 terminal to be installed in the shell itself. So our testing related to head and neck restraint devices is making sure that those anchor points that are in the shell are secure and they're properly located based on the FIA specification for testing that do the physical pull testing with the device linked to the helmet, that those anchors are going to stay in the shell and going to be in the proper position. That's really the focus of Bell's testing with head and neck restraint devices.
So just making sure that everything is compatible with all the popular things out there, and there's nothing any safer than anything else, I would imagine, which you know would certainly not make your customers happy.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just making sure that from a customer standpoint, it's better for them because, you know, we've already done the inserts into the helmet. So when the anchors are installed, you know, it's not something that they're going to have to put a back plate behind between the liner and the shell and install the anchor themselves. So it's just, you know, less the consumer is going to have to do to the helmet itself to make sure it's compatible with head and neck restraint devices.
All right, so we actually have a new rollout here of a new Snell specification coming out pretty soon. Is that in effect yet, or is that still right around the corner for the Snell 15s?
That's really right around the corner.
Okay.
We can't release any of the Snell 2015 homologated products until October 1st of this year. So,
how different were the standards for this year? Or are you even allowed to talk about that? Like, how much did they change from the 2010 standards?
They changed somewhat. Essentially, what they've done is they've just on certain impacts. They've increased the energy threshold slightly, and then they've also changed some of the G thresholds as well. And then they've also added another impact. It's a low velocity impact. So, you know, for example, we're designing helmets for large, massive impacts, but then also they want to make sure that, you know, there's some smaller impacts, you know, that maybe wouldn't register, that the helmet is performing adequately for those. So we've got high velocity impacts that we have to withstand, and then also low velocity impacts that we have to extend as well. But the standard itself has not changed, I would say, dramatically. It's somewhat similar. The real dramatic change we saw was in Snell 2010, when instead of using a standard 5-kilogram head form to test all helmets, they went to a variable weight head form. So the theory there is that you know, every head is different in terms of size and weight, and the smaller the head, the less it's going to weigh, and the larger the head, the more it's going to weigh. So the head forms now are designed to reflect that. So, you know, the smaller size helmets will be tested on a lighter relative head form, and the larger helmets will be tested on a heavier relative head form. So that was really a major sea change in terms of the Snell standard itself. And then the 2015 standard is really a continuation of that, but yet just pushing the envelope just a little bit farther.
So, Bell's obviously a well-established company. I would imagine that there's never too much worry around the office that you guys aren't going to make the new standards. By how much do you guys normally, is there a certain amount you guys shoot to exceed these standards, or do you have sort of in-house standards that you want to stay a certain amount ahead of the curve, or how's that work sort of with your, you know, company development?
Yeah, I mean, on the standards themselves, I mean, obviously we test at a, you know, energy requirement plus, so to speak. So, you know, we make sure that anything that we send out for homologation that we've thoroughly tested, we're very confident that we'll have no issues. The other thing that we also do is, you know, we do quite a bit of internal testing, batch testing on materials, you know, just to make sure before those things are ever incorporated into a helmet that they meet the specifications that we require. So really a combination of research and development testing on the helmet itself, but then a lot of material testing that's done to make sure that we're not going to get into any surprises when we go to, whether it's an R&D test or we go to a certification test.
Yeah, so speaking of certification, I actually ran into a situation recently where I was looking to do some racing in Europe, and their gear all has to be FIA certified, and a lot of the gear that I was finding in the U.S. may be FIA specification, but doesn't necessarily carry the sticker. Are we kind of? I guess my first question is: so is your stuff FIA certified currently, and are we moving at some point to more of a world standard for this stuff as it gets easier to, you know, to race pretty much everywhere and rules get standardized?
Well, some ways we are, and other ways we're not. You know, for example, the FIA has new standard for 2015 as well. That's called the FIA 8859 2015 standard. Essentially what that is it's basically a step below their 8850 standard. And it's designed to be, you know, somewhat similar to the Snell standard. And going forward in FIA-sanctioned events, mainly outside of North America, helmets are going to have the FIA 8859 standard at a minimum, you know, or the FIA 8860 standard. So that is something for consumers to think about, especially if they race overseas, because if they take, you know, a general Snell 2015 helmet, we're not guaranteed that the FIA, at a sanctioned event, is going to recognize that. So in many cases now, for the 2015 standard, we're going to have snow helmets that are 2015. We're going to have FIA 8859 and 8860 helmets. And then we're going to have some helmets that are dual certified to both Snell and FIA 8859. So for the general consumer, that can get somewhat confusing. So basically what I would say is that starting in 2016 or basically in October of 2015, if someone is going to race overseas outside of North America, I would definitely make sure that they're aware of the homologation requirements for the series or the event that they're going to compete in, because there's no guarantee that a Snell 2015 helmet will be allowed to be used.
Yeah, and even though it may have been built to the same standards and the same model is available overseas, it may not have actually been submitted for testing, being a U.S. model or a European model, I started getting into it. I was very, very surprised that there was sort of a lack of U.S. and European standards for that.
Well, I think in an ideal world, we would have, as you mentioned previously, kind of moving toward more of a one world standard. We're starting to see that in a sense with things like the FIA 8860 standard, where this year we've seen, or last year we saw IMSA and IndyCar adopt that. IMSA for the top two series, and then IndyCar for the regular series, and then now Indy Lights and USF 2000 and Star Mazda and some of those are following suit. So, in some cases we are seeing some standardization, but in other cases we're not. And, I would think at a grassroots level, especially in the United States, sanctioning bodies are going to be more geared toward following the Snell, SFI type regulations versus FIA. But any series that races outside of the United States, or especially outside of North America, they're going to be more inclined to follow more of the FIA standards.
All right, so give me some ideas here. If I'm helmet shopping, and obviously if I'm helmet shopping, it probably helps to be able to try on a helmet and be able to physically touch it. But when I pick a helmet up and sort of examine it and look it over, what are some of the clues that I'm looking for just in the construction some visible or tactilely available clues that helmet is a good helmet? Now, obviously, if it has a Bell sticker on it, it's a fine quality product. But what are some of the, what separates a good helmet from a cheap helmet as far as just looking at the construction or looking at some of the various components there would be, sitting on the shelf?
Well, I think like any other product, it's just really attention to detail. I mean, looking at, the hardware and all the finishing, and looking at the quality of the stitching and how it's constructed, and how durable are the pieces and parts that are on the helmet. I mean, just I think you can get a really good sense of how the helmet is built just by doing sort of a visual inspection and looking at the quality of the materials that are incorporated and how it's put together. And some of those, the stitching and the binding, and some of those, like you mentioned, tactile, is the product using, stainless steel hardware, and does it have Kevlar type chin straps, and just some of the different features that really kind of distinguish, quality products versus those products that are sold strictly on pricing.
All right, so let's say I'm in a situation where I actually have to rely on my helmet to do some work, and I'm in an incident or a crash, and there's an impact. What do I need does Bell want to see that helmet back? Are you guys going to be able to learn something from any impact? Is there anything I can sort of inspect on that helmet to see you know, get a better idea of what happened during that collision, and what's the threshold sort of for, you know, what type of impact renders the helmet no longer viable as a safety device?
Well, the first thing that that we want to know is if someone lost consciousness, you know, in an impact, and if they have, then that tells us that the impact itself was severe enough that, you know, the helmet did utilize some of its energy absorbing capability. So in any kind of incident where you lose consciousness at all, even for a brief moment, we recommend replacing the helmet. In terms of a visual inspection after an accident, the first thing you want to look at is you want to look and see if the shell itself has any evidence of delamination or cracking or any of that, because if that's the case, then that's going to tell you that the shell itself started to delaminate and started to absorb energy. The other thing that we want to look at is we want to look at, see if there's any liner material that's been compressed. And often what you might see is if you look underneath the foam fit pad to the hard liner material, you may see some evidence of liner compression. You may see some you know, areas of the liner that are a little bit softer. And that tells you that, you know, that liner system started to function and started to bring the head to a slower deceleration. And if there's any question, we certainly do inspections for free. And we'll ask the consumer to go ahead and send the helmet in, and we'll look internally at all those aspects to determine whether or not the helmet itself is still sound to be used in competition. The other thing that you know, we've seen improvements on over the last several years is the quality of the seats have improved, especially the seats with the head surround that have energy absorbing materials in the head surround itself. We certainly see roll bar padding. We've seen that improve in terms of, you know, ability to manage energy and quality. So, you know, you should also think about those other types of systems that help to minimize helmet impacts that you might see in an accident.
Yeah, and you know, certainly it's not just accidents we're talking about, but there's, you know, I would imagine a lot of the helmet damage you guys see on these inspections is probably from non-accident damage as well. You know, a helmet gets knocked off a table onto a concrete floor, it falls off somebody's car while they're driving through the grid. You know, how survivable are those types of incidents for the helmet usually?
Usually, I mean, obviously we don't want people dropping helmets off pit walls or dropping them off the top of the car or throwing them at people, you know, out of frustration. We don't want to see any of that. So you really do need to take care of the helmet because, you know, like anything else, I mean, it's designed to be destructive. So any energy that you adhere to it, it's going to respond in a certain way. And so we want to limit that as much as possible. But, you know, simply dropping the helmet, you know, may not necessarily render it unworthy of being worn. You're just going to have to, you know, do a good inspection and take a look at it and make sure that it's in performance-ready condition.
And how much do you enjoy watching the occasional NASCAR fight where two guys are trying to punch through one of your helmets in the infield somewhere? I'd imagine that probably gives you a little bit of satisfaction knowing that they'll never be able to drive their fist through one of those.
Yeah, I think it's a smart thing because the worst thing that's going to happen is they're going to break their hand. So I guess if you do have to get into a fight at the racetrack, you'd rather have your helmet on, I think. So.
All right. So, what? Anything coming up from you guys that we need to know about? Any, you know, obviously with the 2015, any sort of new models coming out or big improvements that you want to share with us?
We do have a number of new models coming out. You know, some replacements for models that have been in our product line for a number of years. So you're going to see. You know, a new GTX series, you're going to see a new, an updated GP2. You're going to see more options in carbon from us in the Snell 2015 standard. And you're going to see, you know, a helmet replacement for a helmet that's been in the product line for a long time and is pretty popular with grassroots sports car racers, and that's the M4. There's going to be a replacement for that called the M8 with some pretty nice features and still going to be a nice affordable price point. So a lot of things that are happening within the product line and a lot of new models that will be released in October.
And you guys have some cool sort of retro vintage looking helmets out there that are current safety specs now too, don't you?
We do. You know, one of the things we wanted to do is the vintage market has you know continued to be strong, and so we wanted to kind of go back and give people the option of buying a helmet with modern technology that essentially looked like something that would have been worn in the era in which that car would have competed. So we brought out a helmet called the 500TX, which kind of replicates that open face style of helmets that you would have seen kind of in the early 60s through late 60s, early 70s. And then we've got a model called the Star Classic that sort of replicates what you would have seen in the early to mid 70s in racing, sort of kind of a real iconic era. You know, for example, that helmet was used in the movie Rush because it really looked very authentic to what the drivers would have wore in that era. And then there's another helmet that we brought out called the XFM1 Classic, which was kind of an early 80s period helmet that you would have seen, you know, especially in IndyCar racing or sprint car racing back in that era. So we've tried to, you know, kind of bring those iconic designs, you know, into forward, updating them for the modern safety specs.
No bubble shields though yet, right?
No bubble shields. Although on the motorcycle side, there's a DOT version of the old open face helmet that does have a bubble shield. So for the motorcycle guys, you could get the bubble shield.
Actually, so talk about, just before we get out of here, talk about real quickly the difference between an M-spec helmet and an SA-spec helmet. So obviously an SA-spec helmet is required for road racing in most cases, but for an autocross guy, they can use an M-spec helmet, which widens their options considerably. What are the actual differences between the M and the SA?
One of the things you have to be careful about when you look at better M helmets, or non-auto helmets, make sure the consumer is not getting them confused with a regular standard DOT motorcycle helmet versus a Snell motorcycle helmet. As those specifications and those standards are quite different. Snell requirement is a more stringent requirement than DOT. So that's one thing to consider. The other thing to consider is that with the auto helmets, there's a fire component standard that differs it from the SM standard for the regular SA. And then there are some different anvils that we test to. And that is the edge anvil and the roll bar anvil. And so we have to test in the auto side, not only the flame standard, but also to some of the impact anvils that you might see in an auto accident. So, you know, certainly a roll bar or more of an edge or something that you might see hitting a steering wheel. So SA standard is really designed to be true auto racing standard. So even if you're doing autocross, you might want to think about the fact that you may decide to do something, you know, at a track day or at an event that may require an SA standard. So, you know, if you're just doing autocross, think about what you might do in the future and maybe look at an auto helmet, because that gives you more flexibility if you go out and do something outside of autocross.
Yeah, and certainly if you've got a roll cage in your car, you know, the types of impacts the helmet's been tested for is going to be more conducive to that type of environment. So, all right, Kyle Kitzman, thank you very much for hanging out with us for a while. We'll let you get back to work. Hang on for 1 second while we stop recording. Make sure we hit save here on our end. But thanks very much for being with us. We definitely appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and certainly for all those folks out there that wear Bell, we appreciate your support.
Yeah, give us an idea real quick. Do you guys do direct sales? Do you recommend going to a distributor, or what's the best way if I wanted a new Bell helmet to go out and get one?
Well, we've got a number of fantastic dealers and distributors. The best thing to probably do would be go to bellracing.com and look at our dealer network and see if there's a retailer in your area. As certainly we would recommend people trying on helmets if they can, and then if they can't find a retailer, you can certainly buy those direct from Bell.
And is there a generous return policy if something just doesn't fit your head? You guys try and work with folks to get stuff right on that end?
Yeah, we certainly do. excuse me, we have. All right. Man.
You almost made. We're almost done.
Just a second. Let me get some water here.
Go ahead, man.
Okay. Certainly, we do have a return policy, and if a helmet doesn't fit, then we can certainly exchange it for the proper size.
Cool. Excellent. Kyle, because we've maxed you out today. Thanks very much for hanging out with us.
I appreciate that.
There you go. Kyle Kitzman from Bell Helmets. I really got to hand it to the guy. He was a really good sport. He made it like 48 minutes and just ran out of water or didn't have it close enough or whatever and just kind of locked up there. I've done the exact same thing myself after 45 podcasts. I've kind of learned to keep my delicious crisp refreshing cup of Pepsi Max very, very close. It the fizzies sort of coat your throat and keep it nice and moist and ready to talk. But he almost made it, and I felt bad for him, but he recovered well and strong finish. So good for him. He's got a future in this thing. He did a great job. All right, grassrootsmotorsports.com/discount, classicmotorsports.com/discount to subscribe to one of our magazines. Get 20% off just by going to one of those URLs. grassrootsmotorsports.com and classicmotorsports.com, of course, the web pages for both of our print magazines. And you can go there and do fun stuff. Lots of editorial from the magazines is gathered there. Very active, interactive forums there where you can interact with the magazine staff and other readers and all very cool stuff. And just a fun place to spend a rainy afternoon or to close your office door and do some fun stuff for a while. So that is it for this episode. We'll be back in a couple weeks with something else exciting. Got some fun. Actually, I have a few safety things in the pipe. So this is kind of our sort of early season getting safety stuff kind of worked out and getting you guys some good info on safety gear if you're thinking about doing something different this year with your safety gear. So in the next couple months, you'll be hearing actually a few different safety related podcasts and a bunch of other stuff that I can't even tell you about yet, mostly because we haven't done it, but partially because I want to keep it a secret because it's going to be super awesome. All right, that's it. I am JG Pastorjack. You are the listeners. This is the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast. Thank you once again for being along for 46 big episodes, and we will see you in a couple weeks. Enjoy. Thanks, everybody.